planet Earth is home to two very real worlds, and the Christian happens to be in contact with both of them. Augustine referred to them as the city of man and the city of God. The city of man is that physical world around us, and we engage in it with our senses of sight and touch and taste and hearing and smelling. But at the same time, the Christian is very aware of another world, just as real, an invisible world. In fact, it is eternal. It's a world that we connect to, not by means of senses, but by means of the Spirit. The designer and creator of both worlds is the same person, our Creator God. Now, most of the world would agree with everything I said until I got to that last point. They believe in something out there beyond the city of man. Just don't talk about a designer or sovereign creator. William Irwin Thompson likened our unbelieving world to flies crawling across the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, blissfully unaware of the magnificent shapes and forms and colors and design that surround them. And it's so true. Oblivious to spiritual reality, they even might deny it exists. Certainly the sweep of evolution has gained the majority opinion in our culture that there is no designer in the creative painting that surrounds us all. Some even take the time to study the complexity of the patterns of the painting, but then they deny that it ever had a painter, that someone outside the world of flies and insects actually designed and painted this incredibly beautiful mural. Educators are busy washing off the walls of history and science any reference to him. The politically incorrect crime of our generation is to state with any sense of certainty that he's even around, much less responsible for the painting. And if you really want to shake things up, mention that he not only painted it, but he owns the ceiling, he owns the chapel, he owns the ground upon which it stands, he owns the earth, and by the way, it's his universe too. We have watched over the last several decades, especially concerted efforts of our world to remove the signature of the painter from the mural of his universe. I just read this past week of one more case, this one brought before the U.S. Court of Appeals. Just a couple of months ago, the court ruled against a little town in New York for opening its town council meetings with prayer. And you automatically think, by this time, well, certainly there's no surprise there. We knew they had that coming. But what makes this ruling so strange is that the town had already tried to be politically correct by inviting a variety of religious leaders to open in prayer. They even brought an atheist in who evidently didn't know what he was praying about anyway to begin with, but they invited him. They even invited a Wiccan priestess to pray. But the court wrote in its conclusion, and I quote, "The town's prayer practice has the effect of affiliating the town with Christianity," end quote. Even the concept of prayer is just too Christian, so we got to abandon it. If I were God, somewhere along the line here, I'd start putting stuff in the clouds, you know, like, hello, excuse me, something, you know, rain pink this morning, or send Skittles cascading down so that people have to admit there's somebody up there. God evidently isn't intimidated by unbelief. He evidently isn't intimidated by being ignored or disrespected. But we are. In fact, we can become frustrated and resentful and bitter as we watch his signature being erased. One author wrote, "In reaction to the rapid and pervasive escalation of immorality and ungodliness in our generation, believers have become both saddened and angered. Hostility among some of them has even intensified still further when they learn that their taxes are being used to fund ideas and practices that only a generation ago was condemned even by most secularists. They fear now for their children and even more for their grandchildren because of the kind of world into which they will be born, educated, and have to live in. And I would agree, there's a growing antagonism in the Christian community to government. There's a growing pessimism, if not frustration, toward institutional authority. There's a growing movement of isolation among believers. I'm even hearing Christian leaders with followings of millions of people suggesting maybe it's time we stop paying taxes. Maybe it's time we just kind of abandon culture altogether and let's all head for the hills. You know, sort of the attitude of, you know, the city of man is going to hell, and so I'm just going to give all of my attention and money and interest, and it's all going to go to the city of God. Has it ever occurred to you that the reason Jesus Christ did not take us immediately to heaven upon our salvation was because he wants us to live in the city of man, demonstrating the reality of the city of God? And the greater the difference between those two cities, the more remarkable our demonstration becomes. And by the way, the world that you might be growing to resent, that you might become angry with, is not your enemy. It is your mission field. And it's not really doing anything we shouldn't be expecting it to do. So what do we do about it? How do we live in the city of man while we wait for the city of God? Well, the believers living in the first century certainly asked the question, and they would be asking the question about this time in the letter of Paul to Titus, okay, what do we do now? I mean, you've told us how to act in church in Titus chapter 1. You've told us how to relate to each other in the church primarily in chapter 2. Is that it? Is that the end of our obligations and our responsibilities while living temporarily in the city of man? Well, hang on to your hat, because Paul is about to inform them that Christianity does not remove the Christian from society. It makes the Christian a productive member of society. Christianity does not call for you to become an isolated citizen. It makes you a better citizen, and for the right reasons. You see, Christianity does not relieve any of us of civic duty. It actually enforces it. Are you serious? Well, I want you to get ready, dear flock. In fact, I've simply entitled this series through chapter 3, Remarkable Christianity, because we're going to discover that Christianity should make every one of us remarkable standouts in the city of man as we ultimately represent the city of God. And the first area where Christians show remarkable distinction is in their attitude toward those in authority, their attitude and their response to rulers. Would you notice now verse 1 of Titus chapter 3? Titus, he's saying effectively, remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient. Now the opening verb is in the present tense, by the way, so that Paul is telling Titus, remind them and remind them again, and remind them again, and keep on reminding them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient. And the first reminder here is in their response of respect to their civil authority. You see, if you traveled back in time to the island of Crete in the first century, you would have, as I have found in my own research, discovered a people who had earned sort of an empire-wide reputation for being disgruntled, dissatisfied, ornery people. In fact, they were always involved in some kind of plotting, some kind of conflict, and they hated Roman rule. In fact, Plutarch, the first century historian who lived during the time of Titus' ministry on the island of Crete, wrote that Cretans were always on the verge of revolting. I mean, they had a chip on their shoulder. You try to knock it off, and we're ready to revolt. Give us a reason. Give us an excuse. We'll tell you what we think about authority. And, of course, the large Jewish population there would not have hesitated to lend a hand in any kind of revolt against Rome. Add to that, and keep in mind, as we've already learned in previous studies, that the island of Crete had for generations been a haven for pirates. I mean, this is an island that reveled in a swashbuckling, self-serving style of independence that answered to nobody. Cretans had become a byword, a nickname for liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. Titus chapter 1 verse 12. Not exactly the kind of people who respond well to authority. So Titus, remind these believers, you've come out of this culture, but don't act now like your forefathers. They may have pirate blood in their veins, but you're a new creature in Christ, and you're going to stand out remarkably different in your respect to authority. In the original language here, Paul uses two infinitives and two nouns. He kind of squishes them together so that it can read, be subject, be obedient to rulers, to authorities. And here's the radical thought. Christians are not above the law. We can't say, hey, look, we belong to the city of God, so phooey on all you people living in the city of man. We're above you. We're beyond that. Not quite. In fact, if you went over, and I'll just briefly mention it, we don't have time, but if you go over and explore Paul's broader explanation of this issue in Romans chapter 13, you discover several mind-altering principles related to the issue of secular government. The first thing you discover, both in Romans and here in Titus, is that obedience to governmental rulers and authorities is not an option, but a command. Paul is not suggesting this. He's commanding this. Titus, remind them this is a command from the breath of God. You are to respond to your authority. So what that means is we don't have to pray over whether or not we're going to pay our taxes. You don't have to put that on your prayer list. Would you help me pray about that? I'm not quite sure. So would you add that to your... No, I don't think so. You don't have to pray about meeting city codes for your building process. Do you know how challenging it is with a campus this size to just meet those codes? Hey, wait a second. We belong to the city of God. No, you're living in the city of man. How are you going to respond? See, you're supposed to pay an honest wage, and there is a minimum wage according to the government. How do you respond? You got to get your car inspected. You got to pay that registration fee, and you got to stand in that line at DMV forever and ever and ever and ever. And they don't seem very happy to see you showing up, which I don't understand. We're paying them. Christians don't get a free pass. Paul also informs us, he implies it here in Titus, he makes it clear in Romans 13 that the institution of government is the creation of God. It's his idea. He wrote to the Romans, for there is no authority except from God ultimately. And those on the planet which exist are actually established by God. In other words, every civil and political power has actually been appointed by God. The Apostle Peter wrote it this way, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors, note this, as sent by him. Keep in mind, it's as if they have been sent by God, even though they deny him or maybe believe in him. It doesn't matter. They have been appointed by him. So we engage in the due process as citizens of our beloved country. And the freedoms that we now enjoy, we gladly vote, we gladly speak our conscience, we declare our virtues, and we don't just talk about values. We can rest at the same time with complete confidence that God's purposes will not be thwarted. He has every office and every officer under his control. Every judge is a minister of his providential direction, and the heart of every king is in the palm of his hand. There's no reason for a Christian to panic or get angry. Fear and resentment about the culture around us may be an indicator that the church thinks that God is not keeping up, that he's letting things slip out of control, and what in the world must he be thinking? He's AWOL. So I'm going to give up. I'm going to buy some land somewhere, and I'm going to go away and create my little community and disappear. No, if we understand these implications, maybe you're supposed to run for office. Maybe you're supposed to be a judge or an attorney. Maybe you ought to write a gracious, informative letter to the editor. Maybe you ought to serve on the education board. Perhaps you ought to volunteer in some kind of capacity in the community. Take your candle out there and shine the light in the city of man and demonstrate remarkable Christianity as you ultimately represent the city of God in the way that you act and respect and treat authority. Which lets us uncover one more principle in our response to rulers, and that is the Christian is to obey authority regardless of that authority's attitude toward the gospel. And don't forget that when Paul is writing this letter, Nero's on a rampage. He's on the throne. Society is depraved as ever. There were no sexual norms at this time. Heterosexuality was considered prudish by the elite Roman society. The emperor was bisexual. Pedophilia, adultery, idolatry, abortion, prostitution, drug addiction were not only empire-wide, they were legal and openly acceptable. And this was the century in which Jesus Christ planted the living church and the church exploded into existence. Why? Among other reasons, because Christians were so remarkably different in this new thing called the church than their culture. They had respect for authority. These children of pirates could care less. You got around authority. Even when authority hated the very ground that Christians walked upon, in fact, Rome will eventually demand that Christians express their allegiance to the city of man by actually offering a pinch of incense and declaring Caesar as Lord, and Christians will die as martyrs rather than attempt to overthrow the emperor. They simply refused to deny that Christ alone was Lord. So is it ever right to disobey the law? Absolutely. Whenever the will of the law demands that you violate the word of God, you stand with the apostles and say, we will obey God rather than man. Rather than mount an insurrection or instigate a plot to overthrow Nero, Paul is actually delivering rather shocking news that they are to respect and pay taxes to Nero, the authority of the land, to keep the law of the land, unless it causes them to violate the word of God. And at that point, they are willing to lay down their lives and die. And the Christians did what? They did that and they sang on their way to their execution. They'd served the city of man as bright lights, and they knew now they were about to enter the city of God according to the will and providence and direction and purpose of God. And the world then could only shake its head in wonder at those remarkable people. So, before I leave this, let's practically apply it in a few ways. And when it gets too convicting, I'll move on. What's your attitude toward the authority in your life? I mean, we're all under the authority of somebody. Everyone in this auditorium is. What's your attitude toward the authority of your parents? Man, I can't wait to get out of the house. What's your attitude toward the authority of your teachers, your supervisors, your pastor's elders, your town council, the IRS, as you fill out those forms, when you meet your hunting or fishing quota, when you write out your check for property taxes, what's your attitude when the police officer pulls you over? I really don't want to go there, so we're going to keep moving on fairly quickly. But what do you do at a red light at 1 a.m. when nobody else is on the street? You're wondering, was he there? Did I see? No, I wasn't there. I just pulled that out of the air. I watched one television show some time ago where young children in kindergarten, one at a time, as part of an experiment on how they respond to the authority, were put in a room with toys and a plate of freshly baked chocolate chip cookies. And they were told they could play with the toys, but they couldn't eat any of the cookies until the teacher came back into the room, and then the teacher left. Then the tape began to roll, and the agony was terrible. Some kids immediately walked over to the plate and just stared at the cookies, just stared and stared. And some started talking to themselves, don't eat the cookies, don't eat the cookies, don't eat the cookies, don't eat the cookies. One kid went over to the corner, just banged his head against the wall. Well, the truth is the camera is rolling. People are probably watching. But even if they aren't, what does your spirit say? What is your attitude? What is it communicating to you as it relates to authority? Anything remarkable there? Okay, I'll knuckle under. You know, the Bible's clear. I need to get with it and obey the law. Well, that's great. But I got to warn you, the Apostle Paul is just getting started. You'll notice that he not only has something to say about how we relate to rulers, he has five commands about how we relate to others. Let me give them to you as we work through this quickly. The first thing he says effectively in relating to others is to go the extra mile. Notice the last part of verse 1. Be ready for every good deed. There's eagerness in that phrase. Be ready. It's as if in your mind, it's on your mark, get set, and you're ready. You're ready to go out of your way to serve your community, its leaders, its citizens, as you live in the city of man, with the truth you represent. That's how we're salt and light. Be ready for good deeds. That means that Christianity does not give us a free pass from society. And this attitude is going to be remarkably different from the status quo. The Jewish community on the island of Crete, in fact, throughout the Roman Empire, urged separation from local culture. And they all just kind of huddled together. In the first century, Jews who lived outside of Israel formed tight-knit communities where nobody got in and nobody went out. Historians say they were slow and reluctant to submit to local laws and authorities. They felt they were above it. One author wrote that they treated the people around them with a thinly veiled disdain. Rather than live among the people and demonstrate the glory and character of God, they kept to themselves and did nothing at all in what they would have defined as secular society. So now they come to faith in Jesus Christ. We want to stay in our little community. Let's just hang around each other. You know, let's not in any way be touched by secular society, which means you can't touch it. Maybe you're thinking, well, you know, Paul's telling the church to do that to each other. Well, certainly that's a biblical principle. Galatians 6 says, you know, do good to all people, especially those of the household of God. Absolutely should be emphasized above everything here. But Paul isn't just talking about us. In fact, you'll notice he ends his statement here with the clarification that we're to do these things to all men, not just believers. So what does my heart communicate about this idea of going the extra mile? What do my hands communicate? My feet, my spirit? Is it, I'm going to let somebody else do that, or I'm ready? I'm on ready. See, at any moment on this occupied island, a Christian could feel the touch of the flat of a Roman spear on his shoulder, and he knew he was immediately by law compelled to carry that soldier's gear for 1 mile. Everybody despised the practice. The people of Crete, the Jewish community especially, no doubt believers. Why would you want to interrupt your schedule and walk a mile out of the way? A Roman mile was considered 1,000 steps. And it's not too much of a stretch of the imagination to imagine that that person then picks up that gear and that backpack and he begins to walk beside that soldier and he counts out loud. 1, 2, 3, 4. And just the attitude and the way he's counting. 5, 6, 997, 998, 999, 1,000. Plop. There's your gear. I'm out of here. And Jesus Christ prepares the way for the church and the preaching of these distinctives all the way back in Matthew chapter 5. And he says, whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. That's where we get the phrase going the extra mile. Can you imagine the surprise of a Roman soldier if you were to say, hey, listen, I know I've counted out 1,000 steps, but I'm willing, because of my obedience to Jesus Christ, my Savior, to carry your gear 1 more mile. You want to demonstrate remarkable Christianity in the church and in your community? Be ready to go the extra mile. Secondly, avoid the grapevine. Avoid the grapevine. Paul writes further in verse 2, malign no one, as that verse opens. Malign no one. The verb is from the Greek word blasphemeo, which gives us our word blasphemy, to blaspheme. Only in this context, it's referring to slandering another person. Slander no one. And note that Paul does not add the loophole, slander or malign no one, if the information isn't true. If it's true, let it rip. No, malign no one. And his directive for the believer couldn't be any clearer. We can't abuse or insult with our lips. We can't run down politicians. We can't run down fellow believers. We can't run down colleagues at work or students on the campus or family members and ever hope to elevate the reputation of the gospel. In fact, when we engage in that, we're just like them. We're not remarkable. We're status quo. I mean, that's the kind of activity the city of Man has mastered. One historian said of Crete and the first century culture, that verbal slander was practiced as a fine art. I mean, they had it down. In that dog-eat-dog world, I mean, they knew how to swing that sword and cut a path to the top. The verb is here subordinate to the opening imperative, which implies then that Paul is saying, Titus, you're going to have to remind them again that remarkable Christianity does not run people through the mud. So what does that mean? Well, take words out of your vocabulary that would be insulting, demeaning. Words like stupid, jerk, fool. I'll never forget talking to a man after a service who since left the church years ago, moved away. Nobody's here, so don't look around. His family had evidently been waiting outside and didn't know where he was. He was in here talking to me. The auditorium had just about emptied out when his middle school-aged son spotted us and ran up to his dad and said, we've been looking all over for you, you idiot. I know. I turned pink. Just, you know, thoughts of capital punishment were becoming clear to my mind. I just stood there silently waiting And I watched with amazement as this man never corrected his son. It occurred to me later that more than likely this was the language of the father in the home. And it never registered. We happen to be living in a demeaning, crass, vulgar, rude society. Which is great news. Because we can demonstrate a remarkable distinction in the way we talk. You go the extra mile. Avoid the gutter of the grapevine. Next, Paul writes in verse 2, be peaceable. It's a word that literally means a no brawler. You're not looking to drop your gloves. You know, just give me an opportunity. I'll put it in another way for your outline's sake. If you're taking notes, this is Paul's third command in regard to relationships with others. And you can say it this way. Remarkable Christianity does not swing back. Even if you have what many might consider a good reason to take a shot, you don't do it. Let me help us all to clarify what this would mean by way of application when you simply think of the Apostle Paul's own experience. He's writing this letter to Titus, and he's writing this, malign no one, don't take a shot. He said those things, and he has been bound up in the legal culture of his Roman world. Roman governors, through pride and incompetence, have kept him bound in prison for years. Roman authorities illegally bound him. They've beaten him with rods. They've delayed hearing charges against him. And then when the charges were presented, even though he was not found guilty, they kept him under house arrest for several more years. In fact, up until the point where he is eventually executed. If anybody had a good reason to write a letter, it wouldn't be to Titus. It would have been to the Roman Senate. And let me tell you a thing or two could have been his attitude. I mean, he could have growled at every changing of the Roman guard. He could have complained all over again every time he got a fresh set to guard him. He could have demanded better treatment as a freeborn Roman citizen. Yet he's sitting in a cell in a place called the Rat's Nest, and he writes, in everything give thanks. We know he witnessed to these soldiers because in letters he'll remark by name to those within the military in giving greetings to them who are now believers. And they must have left their watch, scratching their heads and saying to each other, that guy, man, is he remarkable or what? I recommend to my seminary students, I teach a course a year usually, the small biography of Robert Chapman. I've mentioned him before, but he was the pastor of a small church in 19th century England. He was single his entire life, pastored a very small church his entire ministry, yet made a significant contribution to his community and those who knew him. Charles Spurgeon, in fact, called him the saintliest man in England. That's saying something, huh? But not everybody liked Robert Chapman. He had his enemies. A grocer in the community hated him. In fact, he'd be so infuriated if Chapman ever came near his store with any kind of open air witnessing or preaching. And on more than one occasion, he walked past Robert Chapman while he was preaching and spit in his face. He would verbally attack Chapman as he came around. Chapman never retaliated. He never struck back. And on one occasion, some of Chapman's wealthy relatives came to visit him. Since Robert was single, they convinced him, look, let us buy the groceries and let us cook for you for this week or two that we're with you. And Chapman agreed. They asked him where he would recommend they go to purchase their groceries. And he insisted they go to the grocery of this man who had insulted him for so many years. Now, they didn't know anything about the drama, but Chapman insisted that they travel to the other side of town to do their shopping in his store, and so off they went. They ended up purchasing a lot more food than they could carry, and so they asked that it all be delivered to the home of R.C. Chapman. The stunned grocer asked them to repeat that address, and they did. And then he said, "You must have come to my store by accident." They said, "No. Mr. Chapman insisted that we come and buy this from you." When the grocer arrived with the delivery, and when Chapman answered the door, that old grocer broke down into tears, and Chapman ended up leading him to faith in his Lord that very afternoon. It didn't always happen that way, but sometimes it does. As you set the groundwork of a remarkable Christianity because the world knows you're not like them. With good reason, you refuse to swing back. Fourthly, he tells us to stay the course. He writes in verse 2, to malign no one, to be peaceable. Now notice, to be gentle. And that word doesn't quite grasp the depth of character bound up in its construction. It's an adjective. It's found only 5 times in the New Testament. It refers to someone who is patiently steadfast. That's why I'm saying Paul is commanding us to stay the course. Let me define it to you by reading a definition of a Greek scholar. He said it means this. It refers to someone who is able to submit to injustice, disgrace, and maltreatment without hatred or malice, trusting God in spite of it all. That's why Paul is saying in our vernacular, remarkable Christianity stays the course, and you can add the word sweetly. There's the challenge. That's easy for Paul to say. He's an apostle. He got a tour of heaven. We expect him to write this kind of stuff. No. Paul uses, again, the same word from the dark, cold interior of the rat's nest, a prison designed for people who never got out. And he said, let your gentle spirit be known to all men. Philippians 4:5. The Apostle Peter used the word as well when he wrote, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have so that you can let them have it. Oh, that's not what it says. Always have an answer so you can stick it to them. I like that answer, that translation, but that's not what it says. Let me try one more time. Always be prepared to give an answer, but, 1 Peter 2:12, do this with gentleness and respect. So, to make it practical to us, how do you respond when you're questioned? How do you respond when your faith is ridiculed or challenged? How do you react to debate? You know, one journalist writes about our culture today, and he's right. He writes, reasoned discourse is imperiled. It is giving way now to in-your-face sound bites. Playing hardball is the dominant metaphor for American dialogue. Our interchanges are confrontational, divisive, dismissive. Balance and fairness are casualties on evening shows as 2, 3, sometimes 4 voices contend simultaneously for dominance. Volume and stubbornness are the new civic virtues, which is great news. Because now our spirit can be all the more remarkable as we represent the city of God while living in the city of man. There's one more command from Paul to Titus and to us. I'll simply put it this way. Don't play favorites. He concludes verse 2 by writing, showing every consideration to all men. Do you notice that? Let me give you the literal translation of that Greek word translated all in your text. Ready? It means all. In fact, you could expand it to write in your margin, every kind of man. You could translate it all kinds of people. It isn't just your favorites. People you cotton to. regardless of race, religion, political leanings, social status, education, salary, neighborhood, ethnicity, you just keep adding. All kinds of people show every consideration to them. Be eager. Be ready to meet it. How remarkable is that? Another illustration from my reading of biography, George Whitefield, a spiritual leader in the 1800s, who was an itinerant preacher. He was not allowed to preach in most churches. He was a nonconformist, so he preached outdoors to thousands of people. Remarkable biography. He found out about a widow with a large family whose landlord had recently taken all her furniture away because she couldn't pay rent. He immediately rode a long distance out to her village with a friend. They arrived at her home, and much to her surprise and gratitude, he gave her £5. That's $5 in American money, depending on how sympathetic the exchange rate is. It was enough money back then to pay her rent and get her furniture back. In today's economy, Whitefield's gift was probably more along the lines of $500 to us. As they rode home later that afternoon, Whitefield's friend kind of chided him. You know, you really didn't have the kind of money to give away. And Whitefield said, "When God brings a need before us, it is that we may relieve it, no matter who, no matter what." The two men are riding their horses, and they're suddenly startled when a robber rides his horse up and confronts them, demanding their money. Whitefield didn't have any, but the other guy did. And so the robber got all the friend's money. After the thief rode away, Whitefield turned the tables on his friend and reminded him how much better it was for the poor widow to have his money than the thief. They continued on their journey, but suddenly the robber returned and demanded Whitfield's heavy winter coat. It was wintertime. Whitefield actually graciously agreed without a fuss, took off his coat, gave it to the thief, but then asked the bandit if he could at least have his old tattered coat in exchange because it was a cold day. They exchanged coats. The robber rode away. And they continued on their ride in silence. After some time, if you can believe it, they spotted the robber galloping towards them as fast as he could. Again, and fearing now this time for their lives, the biographer writes, they spurred on their horses and fortunately arrived at some cottages before the robber reached them. The thief had to turn away, and Dalimore recorded, he was no doubt mortified because of what had transpired, for when Whitefield took off the man's tattered coat by the fire, he found in one of the pockets his £5 and in another nearly 100 more. Which means in today's economy, Whitefield gave that widow $500 and got $50,000 back. Now that's my kind of Christianity. Man, I'm ready to be remarkable. Lord, where, who can I give my coat to? Come see me after the service, would you? Listen, we might say, hey, sign me up. Whitefield didn't know how it would turn out. Who would give money to a stranger in need? Who would graciously offer a thief without a fight his coat? And face a winter and a tattered old rag. These are the attributes of remarkable Christianity as he begins. Go the extra mile. Avoid the grapevine. Refuse to swing back. Stay the course. And don't play favorites along the way. This letter, Father, is as fresh and current to us in the 21st century as it was to these believers through their pastor Titus in the first century. You've reminded us that remarkable Christianity isn't some great series of events. It's just little things. It's an attitude. It's a word. It's a response. It's a spirit. Help us in this city of man to serve it well, because of the gospel and the fact that we know full well we are headed for the city of God. Sing with me, "In My Life, Lord, Be Glorified."
In my life, Lord, be glorified, be glorified.
Bless you. Have a wonderful day.